He would not have been ready in 2 months or 2 years if he had not been given a firm date. So, in a quavering voice, he replied, "Yes, Your Holiness, all will be ready by 2 weeks from this day. But this boy is going to have most unfortunate conditions during his life, suffering and torture, disowning by his own countrymen, illness. Every obstacle that one can imagine is being placed in his way by evil forces and by one particular force which I, as yet, do not completely understand but which appears to be connected in some ways with the newspaper workers." The Dalai Lama sighed noisily, and said, "Well, let us put that aside for the time being, because what is inevitable cannot be altered. You will have to go through your charts again during the next 2 weeks to make absolutely sure of that which you are going to declaim. For the moment let us have a game of chess. I am tired of the affairs of state." A silver bell was tinkled, and a golden-robed lama came into the room and received the order to bring the chess set and the chessboard so that the two men could play. Chess was very popular with the higher intellects of Lhasa, but it is a different sort of chess from that which is played in the West. In the West, when a game is started, the first pawn of each party moves 2 steps instead of the normal one as in Tibet, and in Tibet there is no such thing as castling, in which when a pawn reached the back line it could become a castle, nor was the stalemate status used. Instead it was considered that a state of balance or stasis had been reached when the king was left alone without a pawn or without any other piece on the board. The two men sat and played with endless patience, each in the warm glow of love and respect which had grown between these two. And above them on the flat roof just above the Dalai Lama's quarters, the prayer flags flapped in the high mountain breeze. Further down the corridor the prayer wheels clattered, churning out their endless imaginary prayers. On the flat roofs gleams blindingly golden shot from the tombs of the previous incarnations of the Dalai Lama, for in Tibetan belief each Dalai Lama as he died merely went into transition and then returned to earth in the body of some small boy. In Tibet transmigration was such an accepted fact of religion that it was not even worthy of comment. So up on the flat roof 12 bodies lay in 12 golden tombs, each tomb having an intricately designed roof with many spirals, whirls, and convolutions designed to delude and throw off evi one spirits. From the golden tombs one could see across to the gleaming building of the College of Medical Science Chakpor-I on Iron Mountain, the home of medicine for Tibet. Beyond there was the city of Lhasa, now on this day shining bright under the high noon sun. The sky was a deep purple, and the mountains ringing the valley of Lhasa had spumes of pure white snow blowing from their peaks. As the hours rolled on, marked by the growing shadows from the western mountain range, the two men in the state apartments below sighed and reluctantly pushed aside their chess pieces, for now was the time of worship, the time when the Dalai Lama had to attend to his devotions, the time when the chief astrologer had to return to his computations if he were to meet the deadline imposed by the Dalai Lama of 2 weeks. Again the silver bell was tinkled, again a golden-robed lama appeared, and with a few muttered words was directed to assist the chief astrologer to return to his own quarters 3 floors below. The chief astrologer rose creakily to his aged feet, made his ritual prostrations, and left the presence of his spiritual chief. Chapter 2, Oa'i. Oa'i. Ayar. Ayar, said the voice in the dusk of that pleasant day. Did you hear about that Lady Rampa? She's at it again. There was the shuffling of feet on the road, the sound of little pebbles being rolled underfoot, and then a sigh. Lady Rampa. What has she done now? The first voice answered with ill-disguised glee. It seems that for a certain type of woman, no matter her class, no matter her nationality, if she be a bearer of tidings preferably bad, her day is made. My stepson's aunt has heard a strange tale. As you know, she is going to get married to that customs man who works down at the western gate. Her boyfriend has been telling her that for months past Lady Rampa has been ordering all manner of things from India, and now the traders in their caravans are beginning to deliver the goods. Have you heard anything about it? Well, I did hear that there was a special going to be held in their gardens in the near future, but you must remember that the great Lord Rampa was our regent when the inmost one went to India during the invasion of the British that did so much harm. I suppose it's only natural that one of the leading ladies of our country should want that, do you? The informant exhaled gustily and then drew a deep to order something. I don't see what she's doing wrong in breath and declaimed, ah. But you don't know the whole of it, you don't even know the half of it. I've heard tell from one of my friends who serves one of the waiting monks down at the Kizer. He comes from the Potala, you know that a very, very thorough horoscope and life reading is being prepared for that little fellow, you know the little runt who's always getting into trouble and who seems to be such a sore trial to his father. I wondered if you had heard anything about that? The second lady thought a moment and then she replied, yes. But you must remember that Pelja died recently. I saw his body being carried out with my very own eyes. The body breakers carried him out very reverently from the house, and the two priests accompanied H1M as far as the gate, but with my very own two eyes I saw that as soon as the two priests turned back the poor little body was unceremoniously dumped, belly down, on the back of a pony and was taken off to the Ragyab so that the disposers of the dead could break him up and feed him to the vultures. He had to be disposed of. No, no, no. Expostulated the exasperated informer, you miss the whole point. You cannot have much experience of these social matters. With the death of the older boy, that little fellow, Lobsang, is now the heir to the Lalu family estates and fortunes. They are millionaires, you know. They've got money here. They've got money in India, and they've got money in China. I think they must be our wealthiest family. And this little fellow, why should he inherit it all? Why should he have such a life of luxury before him when we have to work? My husband said to me that, never mind, one of these days there will be a change. We shall take the residences of the upper parties and we shall live in luxury and they will one work for us. We shall see what we shall see if we only live long enough. Praise be the day. There had been the sound of slow footsteps coming through the gloaming. Now a faint blur of face could be discerned and the black, black dresses of a Tibetan woman. I could not help hearing what was said, the newcomer announced, but we have to remember that this little lad Lobsang Rampa, he's going to have a hard life ahead of him because all those with money have a very, very hard life indeed. Oh well then, replied the informer, all of us should have a very, very easy time indeed. We've no money at all. Have we? With that she burst into cackles of witch-like laughter. The newcomer went on, well, I've heard it said that a big affair is being planned so that the great Lord Rampa can proclaim his son, Lobsang, to be his heir. I've heard too, that the boy is going to be sent off to India to be trained, and the trouble then will be to keep him out of the hands of the British because the British are trying to get control of our country, you know, and look at the damage they've done. But, no, that boy, rich or poor, he's got a hard life ahead of him, you mark my words, you mark my words. The voices drifted off as the three women went carefully along the Linkor Road, passing along by the Snake Temple, passing along by the Klingchut across the Chirasampa Bridge. Just a few yards away or perhaps a few yards more than that the subject of their discussion, a small boy not yet 7 years of age, tossed restlessly on the hard floor of his room. He was asleep more or less, having fitful dreams, having also frightful nightmares. He was thinking of kites and how awful it would be if it was ever found out that he was the one who was flying the kite that swooped down on the travelers and scared their ponies so much that one of the riders fell off and rolled straight into the river. Such an important man that rider was, too, as assistant to an abbot of one of the Lamasaries. The poor boy turned and writhed in his sleep as in his dream state he thought of all the dire punishments that would be inflicted upon his protesting body should he ever be revealed as the culprit. Life was quite hard for young boys of the leading families in Lhasa. Those boys were supposed to set an example to others, they were supposed to endure hardship to toughen them for the battles of life, they were supposed to have greater hardship than those of lowly birth, to act as an example. To show that even the sons of the wealthy, even the sons of those who ruled the country, could endure pain, suffering, and privation. And the discipline for a boy not yet even 7 years of age was something which Western boys of any age would never endure. From beyond the bridge there came the mumble, mumble of female voices as the three women stopped for a last chat before each departed to her own home. There came on errant breezes the words Rampa, Yasodhara, and then a mumble of voices until at last the gravel beneath their feet stirred restlessly as the women bade each other good night and went each her own respective way. In the great Alua residence, whose massive front gate had so well withstood the assaults of the British infantry that they could gain access only by breaching the stone wall, the family were asleep, all except the guardians of the night, those who stood watch and called out the night hours and the state of the weather so that any who by chance should be awake should know of the progress of the night. Adjacent to the chapel of Alua residence were the stewards' quarters. The highest class Tibetan officials maintained their own chapels in their residence staffed by one or two priests. The Rampa residence was of such importance that two priests were considered absolutely necessary. Every 3 years the priests' monks from the Potala would be replaced by others so that those in household service should not become too effete through their domestic domicile. One of the lamas, for these monks were indeed lamas, had but recently joined the household. The other was soon to leave to return to the stern discipline of the lamasery, and the latter was tossing restlessly, wondering how he could prolong his stay, for it was indeed the chance of a lifetime to see the heir of a great family have his horoscope proclaimed to the public so that all might know in advance what manner of man he would grow up to be. This was a young lama, one who had come to the Alua estate with higher recommendations from his abbot, but he had proved to be a sore disappointment. His amusements were not wholly ecclesiastical, not wholly priestly, for he was one of those who had that which is termed the wandering eye, and his glances strayed ever and again to the young and comely members of the domestic staff. The steward who lived to the left of the chapel had noticed this and had registered a complaint, and so the poor young lama was facing dismissal in some disgrace. His successor had not yet been appointed, and the young man was wondering how he could delay matters so that he could have the fame of being one of the participants in the celebrations and religious services to follow. The poor, wretched steward, also, was having much distress. Lady Rampa was indeed a difficult woman, very harsh in her judgment at times, apt to condemn without giving a man a chance to explain that some of these difficulties were not of his making. Now he had goods on order for some 3 months, and well, everyone knew how slow the Indian traders were, but Lady Rampa was making a terrible commotion and saying that the steward was endangering the success of the whole enterprise by his inefficiency in getting supplies. "What can I do?" he muttered to himself as he tossed and turned on his blanket on the floor. "How can I persuade the dealers to bring the goods on time?" So muttering he rolled over onto his back, his mouth fell open, and he emitted such horrendous snores that one of the night watchmen looked in to see if he was dying. Lady Rampa was turning restlessly too. She was very socially conscious. She was wondering if the steward was absolutely sure of the order of precedence, wondering if all the messages had been written, all the invitations on the special handmade paper tied up with ribbon and then placed in a cleft stick which fast riders would carry mounted on their ponies. It had to be done just right. She thought, one could not have an inferior receiving an invitation before his superior had received one. These matters leak out, there are ever people anxious to pull down a hard-working hostess who is trying to do the best for her family prestige. Lady Rampa twisted and turned, wondering about the food supplies, wondering if by any chance things would not arrive on time. Nearby in a little room, Sister Yasodhara was fretting bit. Her mother had already decreed what she would wear at the party, and it wasn't at all what Yasodhara wanted to wear, she had different ideas altogether. After all, as she said to herself, this is the one time in the year to really look over the boys and see which one of them would be suitable as a husband in later years, and to look over the boys meant that she too must have something to attract them. Clothing, it must be suitable clothing, her hair must be well brushed with yak butter, her clothes must be dusted with the finest of jasmine. She had to do everything possible to attract what she hoped would be a good husband for the future, but her mothers never understood, they were of a bygone age, they didn't understand at all how young girls had to go along nowadays, they had forgotten such things. Yasodhara lay back and thought, and planned. Could she add a ribbon here or a flower there, how could she improve her appearance? As the night grew older and older and the new dawn, the dawn of a new day, was ready to be born. The booming of conches and the blare of trumpets awakened the fitfully sleeping household. The youngest tramper opened a sleep-bleared eye, grunted, and turned over again to be fast asleep before the turning motion was completed. Down near the steward's office, the night watchmen were going off duty while a fresh shift were taking their places. The most menial of the servants awakened with a start at the blaring noises from the surrounding temples and jumped to their feet, struggling into half-frozen clothes. Theirs was the task of seeing that the smoldering fires were raked and stirred into fresh life. Theirs was the task of polishing the rooms, cleaning the place, before the family got down to see it in its overnight state of untidiness. In the stables where the many horses were kept, and in the farm buildings at the back where the yaks were housed, servants rummaged around, scooping up the manure deposited there by the animals overnight. Dried and mixed with a few scraps of wood, this would provide the staple fuel of Tibet. The cooks reluctantly turned out to face another day. They were tired, and they had been busy for several weeks past preparing food in fantastic quantities and having the additional task of trying to protect the food from the depredations of light-fingered small boys and light-fingered small girls, too. They were tired, they were sick of the whole affair. They were saying to each other, "Why doesn't this thing get started and finished so that we can have some peace again? The mistress has gone off her head, even worse with all the preparations." The mistress, the Lady Rampa, had indeed been busy. For days she had been in her husband's office plaguing his secretaries to provide lists of all the most important people living in Lhasa, and some chosen few from other nearby centers. As well, she made the hard demand that suitable foreigners who could be of beneficent influence later be invited, but here again there was the question, protocol and the order of seniority: who came before whom, who would be insulted in this position when they felt that they should be in that position. It was all a great task, a great trial, a great tribulation, and the servants were tired of getting a list one day and finding that the next day a fresh list would supersede the one issued the day before. For days now the whole place had been scoured. Fine gritty sand had been used to shine up stonework mellowed by age, strong meant servants with cloth around their feet and heavy blocks of stone wrapped in cloth trudged around the house pushing their heavy stone burden across floors that were already mirror bright. In the gardens, weary gardeners on hands and knees went over the ground removing weeds, even removing little stones which were of the wrong color. The mistress of the house was a hard task mistress indeed. This was the high point of her life, the son and heir of the Lalu establishment, one who could be a prince or what? Was to be launched, and only the astrologers would tell what was to be his life. But the astrologers would give no hint, would give no forewarning of what their reading would reveal. The lady of the house, the wife of one of the most powerful men in lay life of Tibet, hoped and hoped that her son would leave the country and be educated elsewhere. She hoped that she would be able to persuade her husband that she should make frequent visits to her son studying in a different country. She hoped to visit different countries. For long she had surreptitiously glanced at some of the magazines brought to Lhasa by itinerant traders. She had her plans, she had her dreams and her ambitions. But everything depended on the verdict of the chief astrologer, and everyone knew how uncaring of one's social position astrologers could be. Now the time was fast approaching when this great party was to be held. Traders were entering by the western gate and making fast footsteps toward the Lalu residence. The wiser ones, or those with greater business acumen, knew that the Lady Rampa would soon fall prey to their wiles if they could produce something new. Something that hadn't been seen in Lhasa before, something which would make her neighbors and social competitors exclaim in feigned or which really concealed frustration and jealousy that they had not had it first. So many a trader made his slow way from the western gate along the Linkor Road, around the back of the Potala, past the Snake Temple to the Lalu residence, there to attempt to beguile the lady of the house with strange exotic items with which she could entertain and amaze her guests. Some took their yak trains and brought their whole stock in trade to the residence so that the lady in person could see precisely what they had to sell, and of course for such an important occasion the prices must be inflated, because no lady who was indeed a lady would even dare to bargain or quibble at the prices asked for fear that the traders would mention to the neighbors that Lady Rampa could not pay the proper price but wanted a discount, or concessions, or samples. Day after day the yak trains went by. Day after day the men from the stables scooped up the bounty from the yaks and added it to the pile of fuel which was so rapidly growing, and indeed much extra fuel would be needed for the cooking, for the heating, and for the bonfires, because who could possibly have a good party without a good bonfire? The gardeners, having satisfactorily cleared the ground of all weeds, turned their attention to the trees, making sure that there were no broken branches, making sure that there were no dead branches which could appear unsightly and lead to an accusation of an ill-kept garden. Even more disastrous would be if some small branch fell upon some noble lady and disarranged her hairstyle, which over hours would have been piled on a special lacquered wooden framework. So the gardeners were tired of parties, tired of work, and yet they dare not slack, for the lady ramper seemed to have eyes everywhere. No sooner would a man sit down for a moment to rest an aching back than she would appear screaming with rage that he was delaying things. At last the order of precedence was decided upon and approved by the great Lord Ramper himself, who personally affixed his seal to each of the invitations as they were carefully prepared by monk scribes. The paper was specially made for the occasion. It was thick paper with a rough edge, almost a deckel edge, in fact. Each sheet was roughly 12 inches wide by 2 feet long. These invitations did not follow the normal size or pattern as used in lamaseries. In lamaseries the paper is wider than it is long, but when there were very important invitations, they were written on a narrower paper which was about twice as long as it was wide, because after the invitation was accepted the paper would be fastened to 2 bamboo rods richly decorated at the ends, and then the invitation would be carefully suspended from a string and used as a decoration to show how important the recipient was. The Lord Ramper was one of the upper 10 families in Lhasa. The Lord Ramper himself was actually one of the upper 5, but Lady Ramper was one of the upper 10, otherwise they could not have married. In view of the fact that each of them had such high social status, 2 seals had to be affixed to the invitation, one for his lordship and one for her ladyship, and then because they were married and had such an extensive estate they had a 3rd seal which was known as the estate seal, and that 2 had to go upon the document. Each seal was of a different color, and the Lady Ramper and the steward were in a state bordering on frenzy lest the messengers were clumsy and did something which would crack the fragile, brittle seals. Special message sticks were prepared. These had to be of exactly the same length and very nearly the same thickness. Each had a special slot at one end which would receive and hold the message. Then just below that slot there was a piece fixed on which bore the family coat of arms. Below the coat of arms there were narrow strands of a very tough paper on which were printed prayers, hoping for protection for the messenger and for a safe delivery of the messages, and hoping that the recipient would be able to accept the invitation. For some time the messengers were carefully drilled in the most imposing manner to ride and deliver the messages. They sat upon their horses waving their message sticks in the air as if they were spears. Then on the signal they would charge forward and one by one would approach the captain of the guard who was drilling them. He, pretending to be the householder or the householder's steward, would graciously accept the message from the message stick which was extended and inclined towards him. He would with great respect take the message and bow toward the messenger who was, after all, the representative of the family. The messenger would bow back, would wheel his horse, and would gallop off from whence he came. When all the messages, or invitations, were prepared they were placed in order of precedence, and the most imposing messenger took the most important message, and so on, and then off they galloped to deliver the invitations. Other messengers would come forward, each take a message, and lodge it in the cleft of a stick and gallop off. Soon they would return and the whole procedure would be gone through again until, at long last, all the invitations had gone out, and now was the trying time when the steward and the others had to sit back and wait and wait, and wonder how many would accept the invitations. Had they too much food? Had they not enough? It was most wearing to the nerves. Some of the guests would be content to stay in the gardens, particularly if they were not of sufficient social status to be accepted into the house itself. But others, well, they were more important and they would have to enter the house. And the representatives of the clergy would also want to see the chapel. So all the lacquer was stripped from the altars and from the altar rails, and men worked with handfuls of cloth which were dipped in moist sand and scraped, and scraped, and scraped until the wood beneath the lacquer was bright and as new. Then a special priming coat was put on, and when that was dry lacquer, many layers of it, was most carefully painted onto the altars and the railings so that in the end the surface shone like the surface of still water on a sunny day. The poor wretched servants were each called before the lady of the house and the steward, and they were carefully inspected to see that their clothing was suitable and to see that everything was clean. If their clothing did not pass muster, then it had to be carefully washed, for which purpose great cauldrons of hot water were prepared. At last, when the tension was reaching its height, all the invitations were answered, all the servants had been inspected, and all their special clothing had been put aside, not to be worn until the day. So a tired household sat back in the late evening to wait the dawn of a new day when fate would be revealed. Slowly the sun sank behind the western mountains, sending up a myriad of scintillating points of light from the ever-present spume blowing from the highest peaks. The snow glowed blood red, and then darkened to blue, and on to purple. At last there was only the faint loom of the darkness of the sky and the glittering pinpoints of light which were the stars. At the Alula residence mysterious points of light appeared amid the well-kept trees. A chance traveller along the Linkor road slowed his step, hesitated, made as if to go on again, and then turned and walked back so that he could see what was afoot, or, more accurately, what was a tree. Excited voices came from the gardens, and the wayfarer just could not resist the temptation to pursue the matter further and to find out what it was that was causing such raised voices and what was, apparently, an altercation. As quietly as he could, he shinned up the rough stone wall and rested his chest on the top with his arms supporting him. Then he could see a novel sight indeed. There was the lady of the house, Lady Rampa, plump, short, almost square, in fact. At either side of her she had two tall servants, each carrying a lighted butter lamp and trying to shield the wavering flame so that it should not be extinguished and arouse her ladyship's sire. Disgruntled gardeners moved disconsolately amid the trees, fixing little butter lamps to certain of the lower branches, and then with flint and steel sparks ignited the tinder. Vigorous blowing produced a flame, and from the flame a piece of well-soaked in butter stick was used to transfer the flame to the butter lamps. The lady was not at all sure where she wanted the lamps. There was endless fumbling about in the darkness with the little flickering lights merely intensifying the purple night. At last there was a commotion and a very large figure came prancing out, shouting with rage, "You're ruining my trees, my trees, my trees, you're ruining my trees. I will not have this nonsense. Extinguish those lamps immediately." The Lord Rampa was mighty proud of his wonderful trees, trees and gardens which were famed throughout Lhasa. He was indeed in a frenzy of excitement in case damage should have been caused to some of the newly budding flowers on the trees. His wife, her ladyship, turned to him with lofty mien and said, "You are indeed making a spectacle of yourself, my lord, in front of the servants. Do you not think I am capable of managing this affair? It is my home as well as yours. Do not disturb me." The poor lord snorted like a bull, one could almost imagine fire coming from his nostrils. He turned angrily on his foot, and hurried away back to the house. There was the sound of a door slamming, a sound so intense and heavy that any less substantial door would surely have been shattered with the shock. "The incense brazier, Timon. The incense brazier. Are you altogether stupid, man? Put it over there, never mind about lighting it now, put it over there." Poor Timon, one of the housemen, struggled along with a heavy brazier. But it was more than one brazier, there were several. The night grew darker and darker, and still the lady of the house wasn't satisfied. But at last the wind blew chill and the moon appeared and cast a frosty light over the proceedings. The man peering over the wall chuckled to himself and dropped down to the road to continue his journey, muttering to himself, "Well, well, if that is the price of being a noble, then glad I am indeed to be merely a humble trader." His footsteps died away in the darkness, and in the garden the butter lamps were extinguished one by one. The staff and the lady of the house departed. In the garden, a nightbird sniffed the strange, unusual smell which came from one of the butter lamps, the wick of which was still smoldering, and flew off with a startled cry of protest.